Execution of the prince's orders did not interest and did not even exist for Alpátych. On reaching Smolensk on the evening of the 4th of August, he put up in the Gachnia suburb across the Dnieper at the inn kept by Ferapontov, where he had been in the habit of putting up for the last 30 years. Some 30 years ago, Ferapontov, by Alpátych's advice, had bought a wood from the prince, had begun to trade, and now had a house, an inn, and a corn dealer's shop in that province. He was a stout, dark, red-faced peasant in the 40s, with thick lips, a broad knob of a nose, similar knobs over his black, frowning brows, and a round belly. Wearing a waistcoat over his cotton shirt, Ferapontov was standing before his shop, which opened onto the street. On seeing Alpátych, he went up to him.
"You're welcome, Yakov Alpátych. Folks are leaving the town, but you have come to it," said he.
"Why are they leaving the town?" asked Alpátych.
"That's what I say. Folks are foolish, always afraid of the French.
Women's fuss, said Alpátych.
"Just what I think, Yakov Alpátych. What I say is, orders have been given not to let them in, so that must be right. And the peasants are asking 3 rubles for carting. It isn't Christian."
Yakov Alpátych heard without heeding. He asked for a samovar and for hay for his horses, and when he had had his tea, he went to bed. All night long, troops were moving past the inn. Next morning, Alpátych donned a jacket he wore only in town and went out on business. It was a sunny morning, and by 8 o'clock it was already hot. "A good day for harvesting," thought Alpátych. From beyond the town, firing had been heard since early morning. At 8 o'clock, the booming of cannon was added to the sound of musketry. Many people were hurrying through the streets, and there were many soldiers, but cabs were still driving about, tradesmen stood at their shops, and service was being held in the churches as usual. Alpátych went to the shops, to government offices, to the post office, and to the governor's. In the offices and shops and at the post office, everyone was talking about the army and about the enemy who was already attacking the town. Everybody was asking what should be done, and all were trying to calm one another. In front of the governor's house, Alpátych found a large number of people, Cossacks, and a travelling carriage of the governor's. At the porch, he met 2 of the landed gentry, one of whom he knew. This man, an ex-captain of police, was saying angrily,
"It's no joke, you know. It's all very well if you're single. One man, though undone, is but one, as the proverb says. But with 13 in your family and all the property, they've brought us to utter ruin. What sort of governors are they to do that? They ought to be hanged, the brigands."
"Oh, come, that's enough," said the other.
"What do I care? Let him hear. We're not dogs," said the ex-captain of police, and looking round, he noticed Alpátych. "Oh, Yakov Alpátych, what have you come for?"
"To see the governor, by His Excellency's order," answered Alpátych, lifting his head and proudly thrusting his hand into the bosom of his coat, as he always did when he mentioned the prince.
"He has ordered me to inquire into the position of affairs," he added. "Yes, go and find out," shouted the angry gentleman. "They brought things to such a pass that there are no carts or anything. There it is again, do you hear?" said he, pointing in the direction whence came the sounds of firing. "They've brought us all to ruin, the brigands," he repeated, and descended the porch steps. Alpátych swayed his head and went upstairs. In the waiting room were tradesmen, women, and officials, looking silently at one another. The door of the governor's room opened, and they all rose and moved forward. An official ran out, said some words to a merchant, called a stout official with a cross hanging on his neck to follow him, and vanished again, evidently wishing to avoid the inquiring looks and questions addressed to him. Alpátych moved forward, and next time the official came out, addressed him, one hand placed in the breast of his buttoned coat, and handed him 2 letters. "To His Honour, Baron Ash, from General-in-Chief Prince Bolkonski," he announced, with such solemnity and significance that the official turned to him and took the letters. A few minutes later, the governor received Alpátych and hurriedly said to him,
"Inform the prince and princess that I know nothing. I acted on the highest instructions here." And he handed a paper to Alpátych.
Still, as the prince is unwell, my advice is that they should go to Moscow. I am just starting myself. Inform them—" But the governor did not finish. A dusty, perspiring officer ran into the room and began to say something in French. The governor's face expressed terror. "Go," he said, nodding his head to Alpátych, and began questioning the officer. Eager, frightened, and helpless glances were turned on Alpátych when he came out of the governor's room. Involuntarily listening now to the firing, which had drawn nearer and was increasing in strength, Alpátych hurried to his inn. The paper handed to him by the governor said this: "I assure you that the town of Smolensk is not in the slightest danger as yet, and it is unlikely that it will be threatened with any. I from the one side and Prince Bagration from the other are marching to unite our forces before Smolensk, which junction will be effected on the 22nd instant, and both armies, with their united forces, will defend our compatriots of the province entrusted to your care, till our efforts shall have beaten back the enemies of our fatherland, or till the last warrior in our valiant ranks has perished. From this you will see that you have a perfect right to reassure the inhabitants of Smolensk, for those defended by two such brave armies may feel assured of victory." Instructions from Barclay de Tolly to Baron Asch, the civil governor of Smolensk, 1812. People were anxiously roaming about the streets. Carts piled high with household utensils, chairs and cupboards kept emerging from the gates of the yards and moving along the streets. Loaded carts stood at the house next to Ferapontov's, and women were wailing and lamenting as they said goodbye. A small watchdog ran round barking in front of the harnessed horses. Alpátych entered the inn yard at a quicker pace than usual and went straight to the shed where his horses and trap were. The coachman was asleep. He woke him up, told him to harness, and went into the passage. From the host's room came the sound of a child crying, the despairing sobs of a woman, and the hoarse, angry shouting of Ferapontov. The cook began running hither and thither in the passage like a frightened hen, just as Alpátych entered.
"He's done her to death, killed the mistress, beat her, dragged her about so."
"What for?" asked Alpátych.
"She kept begging to go away. She's a woman. Take me away," says she. "Don't let me perish with my little children. Folks," she says, "are all gone. So why," she says, "don't we go?" And he began beating and pulling her about so.
At these words, Alpátych nodded as if in approval, and not wishing to hear more, went to the door of the room opposite the innkeeper's where he had left his purchases.
"You brute! You murderer!"
screamed a thin, pale woman who, with a baby in her arms and her kerchief torn from her head, burst through the door at that moment and down the steps into the yard. Ferapontov came out after her, but on seeing Alpátych, adjusted his waistcoat, smoothed his hair, yawned, and followed Alpátych into the opposite room.
"Going already?" said he.
Alpátych, without answering or looking at his host, sorted his packages and asked how much he owed.
"We'll reckon up. Well, have you been to the governor's?"
asked Ferapontov.
"What has been decided?"
Alpátych replied that the governor had not told him anything definite.
"With our business, how can we get away?" said Ferapontov. "We'd have to pay 7 rubles a cartload to Dorogobuzh, and I tell them they're not Christians to ask it. Selivanov now did a good stroke last Thursday, sold flour to the army at 9 rubles a sack. Will you have some tea?" he added.
While the horses were being harnessed, Alpátych and Ferapontov, over their tea, talked of the price of corn, the crops, and the good weather for harvesting.
"Well, it seems to be getting quieter," remarked Ferapontov, finishing his third cup of tea and getting up. "Ours must have got the best of it. The orders were not to let them in, so we're in force, it seems. They say the other day Matvey Ivanich Platov drove them into the River Marina and drowned some 18,000 in one day."
Alpátych collected his parcels, handed them to the coachman who had come in, and settled up with the innkeeper. The noise of wheels, hoofs and bells was heard from the gateway as a little trap passed out. It was by now late in the afternoon, Half the street was in shadow, the other half brightly lit by the sun. Alpátych looked out of the window and went to the door. Suddenly, the strange sound of a far-off whistling and thud was heard, followed by a boom of cannon blending into a dull roar that set the windows rattling. He went out into the street. Two men were running past toward the bridge. From different sides came whistling sounds and the thud of cannonballs and bursting shells falling on the town, but these sounds were hardly heard in comparison with the noise of the firing outside the town and attracted little attention from the inhabitants. The town was being bombarded by 130 guns, which Napoleon had ordered up after 4 o'clock. The people did not at once realize the meaning of this bombardment. At first, the noise of the falling bombs and shells only aroused curiosity. Ferapontov's wife, who till then had not ceased wailing under the shed, became quiet, and with the baby in her arms went to the gate, listening to the sounds and looking in silence at the people. The cook and a shop assistant came to the gate. With lively curiosity, everyone tried to get a glimpse of the projectiles as they flew over their heads. Several people came round the corner, talking eagerly.
"What force?" remarked one. "Knocked the roof and ceiling all to splinters."
"Routed up the earth like a pig," said another.
"That's grand. It bucks one up," laughed the first. "Lucky you jumped aside, or it would have wiped you out."
Others joined those men and stopped and told how cannonballs had fallen on a house close to them. Meanwhile, still more projectiles, now with the swift, sinister whistle of a cannonball, now with the agreeable, intermittent whistle of a shell, flew over people's heads incessantly, but not one fell close by. They all flew over. Alpátych was getting into his trap. The innkeeper stood at the gate.
"What are you staring at?"
he shouted to the cook, who in her red skirt with sleeves rolled up, swinging her bare elbows, had stepped to the corner to listen to what was being said.
"What marvels!" she exclaimed,
but hearing her master's voice she turned back, pulling down her tucked-up skirt. Once more something whistled, but this time quite close, swooping downward like a little bird. A flame flashed in the middle of the street, something exploded, and the street was shrouded in smoke.
"Scoundrel! What are you doing?"
shouted the innkeeper, rushing to the cook. At that moment the pitiful wailing of women was heard from different sides. The frightened baby began to cry, and people crowded silently with pale faces round the cook. The loudest sound in that crowd was her wailing.
"Oh, dear souls, dear kind souls, don't let me die, my good souls!"
5 minutes later, no one remained in the street. The cook, with her thigh broken by a shell splinter, had been carried into the kitchen. Alpátych, his coachman, Ferapontov's wife and children, and the house porter were all sitting in the cellar, listening. The roar of guns, the whistling of projectiles, and the piteous moaning of the cook, which rose above the other sounds, did not cease for a moment. The mistress rocked and hushed her baby, and when anyone came into the cellar, asked in a pathetic whisper what had become of her husband, who had remained in the street. A shopman who entered told her that her husband had gone with others to the cathedral, whence they were fetching the wonder-working icon of Smolensk. Toward dusk, the cannonade began to subside. Alpátych left the cellar and stopped in the doorway. The evening sky that had been so clear was clouded with smoke, through which, high up, the sickle of the new moon shone strangely. Now that the terrible din of the guns had ceased, a hush seemed to reign over the town, broken only by the rustle of footsteps, the moaning, the distant cries, and the crackle of fires, which seemed widespread everywhere. The cook's moans had now subsided. On two sides, black curling clouds of smoke rose and spread from the fires. Through the streets, soldiers in various uniforms walked or ran confusedly in different directions, like ants from a ruined anthill. Several of them ran into Ferapontov's yard before Alpátych's eyes. Alpátych went out to the gate. A retreating regiment, thronging and hurrying, blocked the street. Noticing him, an officer said, "The town is being abandoned! Get away! Get away!" And then, turning to the soldiers, shouted, "I'll teach you to run into their yards!" Alpátych went back to the house, called the coachman, and told him to set off. Ferapontov's whole household came out too, following Alpátych and the coachman. The women, who had been silent till then, suddenly began to wail as they looked at the fires, the smoke and even the flames of which could be seen in the failing twilight, and as if in reply the same kind of lamentation was heard from other parts of the street. Inside the shed, Alpátych and the coachman arranged the tangled reins and traces of their horses with trembling hands. As Alpátych was driving out of the gate, he saw some 10 soldiers in Ferapontov's open shop, talking loudly and filling their bags and knapsacks with flour and sunflower seeds. Just then Ferapontov returned and entered his shop. On seeing the soldiers, he was about to shout at them, but suddenly stopped, and clutching at his hair, burst into sobs and laughter.
"Loot everything, lads! Don't let those devils get it!" he cried, taking some bags of flour himself and throwing them into the street.
Some of the soldiers were frightened and ran away. Others went on filling their bags. On seeing Alpátych, Ferapontov turned to him.
"Russia is done for!" he cried. "Alpátych, I'll set the place on fire myself! We're done for!"
And Ferapontov ran into the yard. Soldiers were passing in a constant stream along the street, blocking it completely, so that Alpátych could not pass out and had to wait. Ferapontov's wife and children were also sitting in a cart, waiting till it was possible to drive out. Night had come. There were stars in the sky, and the new moon shone out amid the smoke that screened it. On the sloping descent to the Dnieper, Alpátych's cart and that of the innkeeper's wife, which were slowly moving amid the rows of soldiers and of other vehicles, had to stop. In a side street near the crossroads where the vehicles had stopped, a house and some shops were on fire. This fire was already burning itself out. The flames now died down and were lost in the black smoke, now suddenly flared up again brightly, lighting up with strange distinctness the faces of the crowd crowding at the crossroads. Black figures flitted about before the fire, and through the incessant crackling of the flames, talking and shouting could be heard. Seeing that his trap would not be able to move on for some time, Alpátych got down and turned into the side street to look at the fire. Soldiers were continually rushing backwards and forwards near it, and he saw two of them and a man in a frieze coat dragging burning beams into another yard across the street, while others carried bundles of hay. Alpátych went up to a large crowd standing before a high barn which was blazing briskly. The walls were all on fire, and the back wall had fallen in. The roof was collapsing, and the rafters were alight. The crowd was evidently watching for the roof to fall in, and Alpátych watched for it too.
"Alpátych!"
a familiar voice suddenly hailed the old man.
"Mercy on us, Your Excellency!"
answered Alpátych, immediately recognizing the voice of his young prince. Prince Andrei, in his riding cloak, mounted on a black horse, was looking at Alpátych from the back of the crowd.
"Why are you here?" he asked.
"Your Excellency!"
stammered Alpátych, and broke into sobs.
"Are we really lost, Master?"
"Why are you here?" Prince Andrei repeated.
At that moment the flames flared up and showed his young master's pale, worn face. Alpátych told how he had been sent there, and how difficult it was to get away.
"Are we really quite lost, Your Excellency?"
he asked again. Prince Andrei, without replying, took out a notebook, and raising his knee began writing in pencil on a page he tore out. He wrote to his sister, "Smolensk is being abandoned. Bald Hills will be occupied by the enemy within a week. Set off immediately for Moscow. Let me know at once when you will start. Send by special messenger to Uzviaj." Having written this and given the paper to Alpátych, he told him how to arrange for the departure of the prince, the princess, his son and the boy's tutor, and how and where to let him know immediately. Before he had had time to finish giving these instructions, a chief of staff, followed by a suite, galloped up to him.
"You are a colonel?"
shouted the chief of staff with a German accent, in a voice familiar to Prince Andrei.
"Houses are set on fire in your presence, and you stand by? What does this mean? You will answer for it!"
shouted Berg, who was now assistant to the chief of staff of the commander of the left flank of the infantry of the First Army, a place, as Berg said, very agreeable and well en évidence. Prince Andrei looked at him and, without replying, went on speaking to Alpátych. So tell them that I shall await a reply till the 10th, and if by the 10th I don't receive news that they have all got away, I shall have to throw up everything and come myself to Bald Hills.
Prince, said Berg, recognizing Prince Andrei, I only spoke because I have to obey orders, because I always do obey exactly. You must please excuse me, he went on apologetically.
Something cracked in the flames. The fire died down for a moment, and wreaths of black smoke rolled from under the roof. There was another terrible crash, and something huge collapsed.
"Ooh!"
yelled the crowd, echoing the crash of the collapsing roof of the barn, the burning grain in which diffused a cake-like aroma all round. The flames flared up again, lighting the animated, delighted, exhausted faces of the spectators. The man in the frieze coat raised his arms and shouted,
"It's fine, lads! Now it's raging! It's fine!"
"That's the owner himself," cried several voices. "Well then," continued Prince Andrei to Alpátych, "report to them as I have told you." And not replying a word to Berg, who was now mute beside him, he touched his horse and rode down the side street. Chapter 5 The Retreat. From Smolensk, the troops continued to retreat, followed by the enemy. On the 10th of August, the regiment Prince Andrei commanded was marching along the high road past the avenue leading to Bald Hills. Heat and drought had continued for more than 3 weeks. Each day, fleecy clouds floated across the sky and occasionally veiled the sun, but toward evening, the sky cleared again and the sun set in reddish-brown mist. Heavy night dews alone refreshed the earth. The unreaped corn was scorched and shed its grain. The marshes dried up. The cattle lowed from hunger, finding no food on the sun-parched meadows. Only at night and in the forests, while the dew lasted, was there any freshness. But on the road, the high road along which the troops marched, there was no such freshness even at night or when the road passed through the forest. The dew was imperceptible on the sandy dust churned up more than 6 inches deep. As soon as day dawned, the march began. The artillery and baggage wagons moved noiselessly through the deep dust that rose to the very hubs of the wheels, and the infantry sank ankle-deep in that soft, choking, hot dust that never cooled even at night. Some of this dust was kneaded by the feet and wheels, while the rest rose and hung like a cloud over the troops, settling in eyes, ears, hair and nostrils, and worst of all in the lungs of the men and beasts as they moved along that road. The higher the sun rose, the higher rose that cloud of dust, and through the screen of its hot, fine particles one could look with naked eye at the sun, which showed like a huge crimson ball in the unclouded sky. There was no wind, and the men choked in that motionless atmosphere. They marched with handkerchiefs tied over their noses and mouths. When they passed through a village, they all rushed to the wells and fought for the water and drank it down to the mud. Prince Andrei was in command of a regiment, and the management of that regiment, the welfare of the men, and the necessity of receiving and giving orders engrossed him. The burning of Smolensk and its abandonment made an epoch in his life. A novel feeling of anger against the foe made him forget his own sorrow. He was entirely devoted to the affairs of his regiment and was considerate and kind to his men and officers. In the regiment they called him Our Prince, were proud of him and loved him. But he was kind and gentle only to those of his regiment, to Timokhin and the like, people quite new to him, belonging to a different world and who could not know and understand his past. As soon as he came across a former acquaintance or anyone from the staff, he bristled up immediately and grew spiteful, ironical and contemptuous. Everything that reminded him of his past was repugnant to him, and so in his relations with that former circle he confined himself to trying to do his duty and not to be unfair. In truth, Everything presented itself in a dark and gloomy light to Prince Andrei, especially after the abandonment of Smolensk on the 6th of August. He considered that it could and should have been defended. And after his sick father had had to flee to Moscow, abandoning to pillage his dearly beloved Bald Hills, which he had built and peopled. But despite this, thanks to his regiment, Prince Andrei had something to think about entirely apart from the general questions. 2 days previously he had received news that his father, son and sister had left for Moscow, and though there was nothing for him to do at Bald Hills, Prince Andrei, with a characteristic desire to foment his own grief, decided that he must ride there. He ordered his horse to be saddled, and leaving his regiment on the march, rode to his father's estate, where he had been born and spent his childhood. Riding past the pond, where there used always to be dozens of women chattering as they rinsed their linen or beat it with wooden beetles, Prince Andrei noticed that there was not a soul about, and that the little washing wharf, torn from its place and half submerged, was floating on its side in the middle of the pond. He rode to the keeper's lodge. No one was at the stone entrance gates of the drive, and the door stood open. Grass had already begun to grow on the garden paths, and horses and calves were straying in the English park. Prince Andrei rode up to the hothouse. Some of the glass panes were broken, and of the trees in tubs, some were overturned and others dried up. He called for Taras, the gardener, but no one replied. Having gone round the corner of the hothouse to the ornamental garden, he saw that the carved garden fence was broken and branches of the plum trees had been torn off with the fruit. An old peasant, whom Prince Andrei in his childhood had often seen at the gate, was sitting on a green garden seat, plaiting a bast shoe. He was deaf and did not hear Prince Andrei ride up. He was sitting on the seat the old prince used to like to sit on, and beside him strips of bast were hanging on the broken and withered branch of a magnolia. Prince Andrei rode up to the house. Several limes in the old garden had been cut down, and a piebald mare and her foal were wandering in front of the house among the rose bushes. The shutters were all closed, except at one window which was open. A little serf boy, seeing Prince Andrei, ran into the house. Alpátych, having sent his family away, was alone at Bald Hills, and was sitting indoors reading the Lives of the Saints. On hearing that Prince Andrei had come, he went out with his spectacles on his nose, buttoning his coat, and hastily stepping up without a word, began weeping and kissing Prince Andrei's knee. Then, vexed at his own weakness, he turned away and began to report on the position of affairs. Everything precious and valuable had been removed to Bogacharovo. 70 quarters of grain had also been carted away. The hay and the spring corn, of which Alpátych said there had been a remarkable crop that year, had been commandeered by the troops and mown down while still green. The peasants were ruined. Some of them, too, had gone to Bogacharovo. Only a few remained. Without waiting to hear him out, Prince Andrei asked, "When did my father and sister leave?" Meaning, when did they leave for Moscow? Alpátych, understanding the question to refer to their departure for Bogacharovo, replied that they had left on the 7th, and again went into details concerning the estate management, asking for instructions.
"Am I to let the troops have the oats, and to take a receipt for them? We still have 600 quarters left," he inquired.
"What am I to say to him?" thought Prince Andrei, looking down on the old man's bald head shining in the sun, and seeing by the expression on his face that the old man himself understood how untimely such questions were, and only asked them to allay his grief.
"Yes, let them have it," replied Prince Andrei.
"If you noticed some disorder in the garden," said Alpátych, "it was impossible to prevent it. 3 regiments have been here and spent the night, dragoons mostly. I took down the name and rank of their commanding officer to hand in a complaint about it."
"Well, and what are you going to do? Will you stay here if the enemy occupies the place?" asked Prince Andrei. Alpátych turned his face to Prince Andrei, looked at him, and suddenly with a solemn gesture raised his arm.
"He is my refuge. His will be done," he exclaimed.
A group of bare-headed peasants was approaching across the meadow toward the prince.
"Well, goodbye," said Prince Andrei, bending over to Alpátych. "You must go away too. Take away what you can, and tell the serfs to go to the Ryazan estate or to the one near Moscow."
Alpátych clung to Prince Andrei's leg and burst into sobs. Gently disengaging himself, the prince spurred his horse and rode down the avenue at a gallop. The old man was still sitting in the ornamental garden, like a fly impassive on the face of a loved one who is dead, tapping the last on which he was making the bast shoe, and two little girls running out from the hothouse carrying in their skirts plums they had picked from the trees there came upon Prince Andrei. On seeing the young master, the elder one, with a frightened look, clutched her younger companion by the hand and hid with her behind a birch tree, not stopping to pick up some green plums they had dropped. Prince Andrei turned away with startled haste, unwilling to let them see that they had been observed. He was sorry for the pretty, frightened little girl, was afraid of looking at her, and yet felt an irresistible desire to do so. A new sensation of comfort and relief came over him when, seeing these girls, he realized the existence of other human interests entirely aloof from his own and just as legitimate as those that occupied him. Evidently these girls passionately desired one thing, to carry away and eat those green plums without being caught, and Prince Andrei shared their wish for the success of their enterprise. He could not resist looking at them once more. Believing their danger past, they sprang from their ambush, and chirruping something in their shrill little voices and holding up their skirts, their bare little sunburned feet scampered merrily and quickly across the meadow grass. Prince Andrei was somewhat refreshed by having ridden off the dusty high road along which the troops were moving, but not far from Bald Hills he again came out on the road and overtook his regiment at its halting place by the dam of a small pond. It was past 1 o'clock. The sun, a red ball through the dust, burned and scorched his back intolerably through his black coat. The dust always hung motionless above the buzz of talk that came from the resting troops. There was no wind. As he crossed the dam, Prince Andrei smelled the ooze and freshness of the pond. He longed to get into that water, however dirty it might be, and he glanced round at the pool from whence came sounds of shrieks and laughter. The small, muddy, green pond had risen visibly more than a foot, flooding the dam, because it was full of the naked white bodies of soldiers with brick-red hands, necks, and faces who were splashing about in it. All this naked white human flesh, laughing and shrieking, floundered about in that dirty pool like carp stuffed into a watering can, and the suggestion of merriment in that floundering mass rendered it specially pathetic. One fair-haired young soldier of the 3rd Company, whom Prince Andrei knew, and who had a strap round the calf of one leg, crossed himself, stepped back to get a good run, and plunged into the water. Another, a dark non-commissioned officer who was always shaggy, stood up to his waist in the water, joyfully wriggling his muscular figure and snorted with satisfaction as he poured the water over his head with hands blackened to the wrists. There were sounds of men slapping one another, yelling and puffing. Everywhere, on the bank, on the dam, and in the pond, there was healthy, white, muscular flesh. The officer, Timokhin, with his red little nose, standing on the dam, wiping himself with a towel, felt confused at seeing the prince, but made up his mind to address him nevertheless.
"It's very nice, Your Excellency. Wouldn't you like to?"
said he.
"It's dirty,"
replied Prince Andrei, making a grimace.
"We'll clear it out for you in a minute," said Timokhin,
and still undressed, ran off to clear the men out of the pond.
"The prince wants to bathe."
"What prince? Ours?"
said many voices, and the men were in such haste to clear out that the prince could hardly stop them. He decided that he would rather wash himself with water in the barn.
"Flesh, bodies, cannon fodder," he thought, and he looked at his own naked body and shuddered, not from cold but from a sense of disgust and horror he did not himself understand, aroused by the sight of that immense number of bodies splashing about in the dirty pond. On the 7th of August,
Prince Bagration wrote as follows from his quarters at Mikhailovna on the Smolensk Road. Dear Count Alexis Andreevich, he was writing to Arakcheyev, but knew that his letter would be read by the Emperor, and therefore weighed every word in it to the best of his ability. I expect the minister, Barclay de Tolly, has already reported the abandonment of Smolensk to the enemy. It is pitiable and sad, and the whole army is in despair that this most important place has been wantonly abandoned. I, for my part, begged him personally, most urgently, and finally wrote him, but nothing would induce him to consent. I swear to you on my honour that Napoleon was in such a fix as never before, and might have lost half his army, but could not have taken Smolensk. Our troops fought and are fighting as never before. With 15,000 men, I held the enemy at bay for 35 hours and beat him, but he would not hold out even for 14 hours. It is disgraceful, a stain on our army, and as for him, he ought, it seems to me, not to live. If he reports that our losses were great, it is not true, perhaps about 4,000, not more, and not even that. But even were they 10,000, that's war. But the enemy has lost masses. What would it have cost him to hold out for another 2 days? They would have had to retire of their own accord, for they had no water for men or horses. He gave me his word he would not retreat, but suddenly sent instructions that he was retiring that night. We cannot fight in this way, or we may soon bring the enemy to Moscow. There is a rumour that you are thinking of peace. God forbid that you should make peace after all our sacrifices and such insane retreats. You would set all Russia against you, and every one of us would feel ashamed to wear the uniform. If it has come to this, we must fight as long as Russia can and as long as there are men able to stand. One man ought to be in command, and not two. Your minister may perhaps be good as a minister, but as a general he is not merely bad but execrable. Yet to him is entrusted the fate of our whole country. I am really frantic with vexation. Forgive my writing boldly. It is clear that the man who advocates the conclusion of a peace, and that the minister should command the army, does not love our sovereign and desires the ruin of us all. So I write you frankly. Call out the militia. For the minister is leading these visitors after him to Moscow in a most masterly way. The whole army feels great suspicion of the imperial aide-de-camp Voltsogon. He is said to be more Napoleon's man than ours, and he is always advising the minister. I am not merely civil to him, but obey him like a corporal, though I am his senior. This is painful, but loving my benefactor and sovereign, I submit. Only I am sorry for the Emperor that he entrusts our fine army to such as he. Consider that on our retreat we have lost by fatigue and left in the hospital more than 15,000 men, and had we attacked, this would not have happened. Tell me, for God's sake, what will Russia, our mother Russia, say to our being so frightened, and why are we abandoning our good and gallant fatherland to such rabble, and implanting feelings of hatred and shame in all our subjects? What are we scared at, and of whom are we afraid? I am not to blame that the minister is vacillating, a coward, dense, dilatory, and has all bad qualities. The whole army bewails it, and calls down curses upon him.
Chapter 6 Anna Pavlovna's and Hélène's rival salons. Among the innumerable categories applicable to the phenomena of human life, one may discriminate between those in which substance prevails and those in which form prevails. To the latter, as distinguished from village, country, provincial, or even Moscow life, we may allot Petersburg life, and especially the life of its salons. That life of the salons is unchanging. Since the year 1805 we had made peace and had again quarrelled with Bonaparte and had made constitutions and unmade them again. But the salons of Anna Pavlovna and Hélène remained just as they had been, the one 7 and the other 5 years before. At Anna Pavlovna's, they talked with perplexity of Bonaparte's successes, just as before, and saw in them and in the subservience shown to him by the European sovereigns a malicious conspiracy, the sole object of which was to cause unpleasantness and anxiety to the court circle, of which Anna Pavlovna was the representative. And in Hélène's salon, which Rumyantsev himself honoured with his visits, regarding Hélène as a remarkably intelligent woman, they talked with the same ecstasy in 1812 as in 1808 of the great nation and the great man, and regretted our rupture with France, a rupture which, according to them, ought to be promptly terminated by peace. Of late, since the Emperor's return from the army, there had been some excitement in these conflicting salon circles and some demonstrations of hostility to one another, but each camp retained its own tendency. In Anna Pavlovna's circle, only those Frenchmen were admitted who were deep-rooted legitimists, and patriotic views were expressed to the effect that one ought not to go to the French theatre, and that to maintain the French troop was costing the government as much as a whole army corps. The progress of the war was eagerly followed, and only the reports most flattering to our army were circulated. In the French circle of Hélène and Rumyantsev, the reports of the cruelty of the enemy and of the war were contradicted, and all Napoleon's attempts at conciliation were discussed. In that circle, they discountenanced those who advised hurried preparations for a removal to Kazan of the court and the girls' educational establishments under the patronage of the Dowager Empress. In Hélène's circle, the war in general was regarded as a series of formal demonstrations which would very soon end in peace. And the view prevailed, expressed by Bilibin, who now in Petersburg was quite at home in Hélène's house, which every clever man was obliged to visit, that not by gunpowder, but by those who invented it, would matters be settled. In that circle, the Moscow enthusiasm, news of which had reached Petersburg simultaneously with the Emperor's return, was ridiculed sarcastically and very cleverly, though with much caution. Anna Pavlovna's circle, on the contrary, was enraptured by this enthusiasm, and spoke of it as Plutarch speaks of the deeds of the ancients. Prince Vasily, who still occupied his former important posts, formed a connecting link between these two circles. He visited his good friend, Anna Pavlovna, as well as his daughter's diplomatic salon, and often in his constant comings and goings between the two camps became confused and said at Hélène's what he should have said at Anna Pavlovna's, and vice versa. Soon after the Emperor's return, Prince Vasily, in a conversation about the war at Anna Pavlovna's, severely condemned Barclay de Tolly, but was undecided as to who ought to be appointed commander-in-chief. One of the visitors, usually spoken of as a man of great merit, having described how he had that day seen Kutuzov, the newly chosen chief of the Petersburg militia, presiding over the enrolment of recruits at the treasury, cautiously ventured to suggest that Kutuzov would be the man to satisfy all requirements. Anna Pavlovna remarked with a melancholy smile that Kutuzov had done nothing but cause the emperor annoyance. "I have talked and talked at the assembly of the nobility," Prince Vasily interrupted, "but they did not listen to me. I told them his election as chief of the militia would not please the emperor. They did not listen to me. It's all this mania for opposition," he went on, "and who for? It is all because we want to ape the foolish enthusiasm of those Muscovites," Prince Vasily continued, forgetting for a moment that though at Hélène's one had to ridicule the Moscow enthusiasm, at Anna Pavlovna's one had to be ecstatic about it. But he retrieved his mistake at once. "Now, is it suitable that Count Kutuzov, the oldest general in Russia, should preside at that tribunal? He will get nothing for his pains. How could they make a man commander-in-chief who cannot mount a horse, who drops asleep at a council, and has the very worst morals? A good reputation he made for himself at Bucharest.
I don't speak of his capacity as a general, but at a time like this, how they appoint a decrepit, blind old man, positively blind, a fine idea to have a blind general, he can't see anything, to play blind man's bluff, he can't see at all.
No one replied to his remarks. This was quite correct on the 24th of July, but on the 29th of July, Kutuzov received the title of prince. This might indicate a wish to get rid of him, and therefore Prince Vasily's opinion continued to be correct, though he was not now in any hurry to express it. But on the 8th of August, a committee consisting of Field Marshal Saltykov, Arakcheyev, Vyazmitinov, Lopukhin, and Kochubey met to consider the progress of the war. This committee came to the conclusion that our failures were due to a want of unity in the command, and though the members of the committee were aware of the Emperor's dislike of Kutuzov, after a short deliberation they agreed to advise his appointment as Commander-in-Chief. That same day, Kutuzov was appointed Commander-in-Chief with full powers over the armies and over the whole region occupied by them. On the 9th of August, Prince Vasily at Anna Pavlovna's again met the man of great merit. The latter was very attentive to Anna Pavlovna because he wanted to be appointed director of one of the educational establishments for young ladies. Prince Vasily entered the room with the air of a happy conqueror who has attained the object of his desires.
"Well, have you heard the great news? Prince Kutuzov is field marshal. All dissensions are at an end. I'm so glad, so delighted. At last we have a man," said he, glancing sternly and significantly round at everyone in the drawing-room.
The man of great merit, despite his desire to obtain the post of director, could not refrain from reminding Prince Vasily of his former opinion. Though this was impolite to Prince Vasily in Anna Pavlovna's drawing-room, and also to Anna Pavlovna herself, who had received the news with delight, he could not resist the temptation.
"But, Prince, they say he is blind," said he, reminding Prince Vasily of his own words.
"Eh? Nonsense! He sees well enough," said Prince Vasily rapidly, in a deep voice and with a slight cough, the voice and cough with which he was wont to dispose of all difficulties. "He sees well enough," he added. "And what I am so pleased about," he went on, "is that our sovereign has given him full powers over all the armies and the whole region, powers no commander-in-chief ever had before. He is a second autocrat," he concluded with a victorious smile.
"God grant it, God grant it," said Anna Pavlovna.
The man of great merit, who was still a novice in court circles, wishing to flatter Anna Pavlovna by defending her former position on this question, observed,
"It is said that the Emperor was reluctant to give Kutuzov those powers. They say he blushed like a girl to whom Joconde is read when he said to Kutuzov, 'Your Emperor and the Fatherland award you this honour.'"
"Perhaps the heart took no part in that speech," said Anna Pavlovna.
"No, no, no," warmly rejoined Prince Vasily, who would not now yield Kutuzov to anyone. In his opinion, Kutuzov was not only admirable himself, but was adored by everybody. "No, that's impossible," said he, "for our sovereign appreciated him so highly before."
"God grant only that Prince Kutuzov assumes real power and does not allow anyone to put a spoke in his wheel," observed Anna Pavlovna.
Understanding at once to whom she alluded, Prince Vasily said in a whisper,
"I know for a fact that Kutuzov made it an absolute condition that the Tsarevich should not be with the army. Do you know what he said to the Emperor?"
And Prince Vasily repeated the words supposed to have been spoken by Kutuzov to the Emperor.
"I can neither punish him if he does wrong, nor reward him if he does right."
"Oh, a very wise man is Prince Kutuzov. I have known him a long time."
"They even say," remarked the man of great merit, who did not yet possess courtly tact, "that His Excellency made it an express condition that the sovereign himself should not be with the army."
As soon as he said this, both Prince Vasily and Anna Pavlovna turned away from him and glanced sadly at one another with a sigh at his naivete. Chapter 7. Napoleon orders an attack on Moscow. While this was taking place in Petersburg, the French had already passed Smolensk and were drawing nearer and nearer to Moscow. Napoleon's historian, Thiers, like other of his historians, trying to justify his hero, says that he was drawn to the walls of Moscow against his will. He is as right as other historians who look for the explanation of historic events in the will of one man. He is as right as the Russian historians who maintain that Napoleon was drawn to Moscow by the skill of the Russian commanders. Here, besides the law of retrospection, which regards all the past as a preparation for events that subsequently occur, the law of reciprocity comes in, confusing the whole matter. A good chess player, having lost a game, is sincerely convinced that his loss resulted from a mistake he made and looks for that mistake in the opening, but forgets that at each stage of the game there were similar mistakes and that none of his moves were perfect. He only notices the mistake to which he pays attention because his opponent took advantage of it. How much more complex than this is the game of war, which occurs under certain limits of time, and where it is not one will that manipulates lifeless objects, but everything results from innumerable conflicts of various wills. After Smolensk, Napoleon sought a battle beyond Dorogobuzh, at Vyazma, and then at Sarevo-Zemysh, but it happened that owing to a conjunction of innumerable circumstances, the Russians could not give battle till they reached Borodino, 70 miles from Moscow. From Vyazma, Napoleon ordered a direct advance on Moscow. Moscou, la capitale asiatique de ce grand empire, la ville sacrée des peuples d'Alexandre, Moscou avec ses innombrables églises en forme de pagode chinoise, Moscow, the Asiatic capital of this great empire, the sacred city of Alexander's people, Moscow with its innumerable churches shaped like Chinese pagodas. This Moscow gave Napoleon's imagination no rest. On the march from Vyazma to Tsarevo-Zemysh, he rode his light bay bob-tailed ambler, accompanied by his guards, his bodyguard, his pages, and aides-de-camp. Berthier, his chief of staff, dropped behind to question a Russian prisoner captured by the cavalry. Followed by Le Lorgne d'Ideville, an interpreter, he overtook Napoleon at a gallop and reined in his horse with an amused expression. "Well?" asked Napoleon. "One of Platov's Cossacks says that Platov's corps is joining up with the main army and that Kutuzov has been appointed commander-in-chief. He is a very shrewd and garrulous fellow." Napoleon smiled and told them to give the Cossack a horse and bring the man to him. He wished to talk to him himself. Several adjutants galloped off, and an hour later Lavrushka, the serf Denisov had handed over to Rostov, rode up to Napoleon in an orderly's jacket and on a French cavalry saddle, with a merry and tipsy face. Napoleon told him to ride by his side and began questioning him. "You are a Cossack?"
"Yes, a Cossack, Your Honour."
The Cossack, not knowing in what company he was, for Napoleon's plain appearance had nothing about it that would reveal to an Oriental mind the presence of a monarch, talked with extreme familiarity of the incidents of the war, says Thiers, narrating this episode. In reality, Lavrushka, having got drunk the day before and left his master dinnerless, had been whipped and sent to the village in quest of chickens, where he engaged in looting till the French took him prisoner. Lavrushka was one of those coarse, bare-faced lackeys who have seen all sorts of things, consider it necessary to do everything in a mean and cunning way, are ready to render any sort of service to their master, and are keen at guessing their master's baser impulses, especially those prompted by vanity and pettiness. Finding himself in the company of Napoleon, whose identity he easily and surely recognized, Lavrushka was not in the least abashed,
but merely did his utmost to gain his new master's favour. He knew very well that this was Napoleon, but Napoleon's presence could no more intimidate him than Rostov's or a sergeant major's with the rods would have done, for he had nothing that either the sergeant major or Napoleon could deprive him of. So he rattled on, telling all the gossip he had heard among the orderlies, much of it true. But when Napoleon asked him whether the Russians thought they would beat Bonaparte or not, Lavrushka screwed up his eyes and considered. In this question he saw subtle cunning, as men of his type see cunning in everything, so he frowned and did not answer immediately.
"It's like this," he said thoughtfully. "If there's a battle soon, yours will win. That's right. But if 3 days pass, then after that, well, then that same battle will not soon be over."
Le Lorgne d'Ideville smilingly interpreted this speech to Napoleon thus: "If a battle takes place within the next 3 days, the French will win, but if later, God knows what will happen." Napoleon did not smile, though he was evidently in high good humour, and he ordered these words to be repeated. Lavrushka noticed this, and to entertain him further, pretending not to know who Napoleon was, added, "We know that you have Bonaparte, and that he has beaten everybody in the world, but we are a different matter." Without knowing why or how, this bit of boastful patriotism slipped out at the end. The interpreter translated these words without the last phrase, and Bonaparte smiled. "The young Cossack made his mighty interlocutor smile," says Thiers. After riding a few paces in silence, Napoleon turned to Berthier and said he wished to see how the news that he was talking to the Emperor himself, to that very Emperor who had written his immortally victorious name on the pyramids, would affect this enfant du Don. The fact was accordingly conveyed to Lavrushka. Lavrushka, understanding that this was done to perplex him, and that Napoleon expected him to be frightened, to gratify his new masters, promptly pretended to be astonished and awestruck, opened his eyes wide, and assumed the expression he usually put on when taken to be whipped. "As soon as Napoleon's interpreter had spoken," says Thiers, "the Cossack, seized by amazement, did not utter another word, but rode on, his eyes fixed on the conqueror whose fame had reached him across the steppes of the East. All his loquacity was suddenly arrested and replaced by a naive and silent feeling of admiration. Napoleon, after making the Cossack a present, had him set free like a bird restored to its native fields." Napoleon rode on, dreaming of the Moscow that so appealed to his imagination, and the bird restored to its native fields galloped to our outposts, inventing on the way all that had not taken place, but that he meant to relate to his comrades. What had really taken place he did not wish to relate, because it seemed to him not worth telling. He found the Cossacks, inquired for the regiment operating with Platov's detachment, and by evening found his master, Nikolai Rostov, quartered at Yankovo. Rostov was just mounting to go for a ride round the neighbouring villages with Ilyin. He let Lavrushka have another horse and took him along with him. Chapter 8. Prince Nikolai Bolkonski is taken ill. Princess Maria was not in Moscow and out of danger, as Prince Andrei supposed. After the return of Alpatych from Smolensk, the old prince suddenly seemed to awake as from a dream. He ordered the militiamen to be called up from the villages and armed, and wrote a letter to the commander-in-chief, informing him that he had resolved to remain at Bald Hills to the last extremity and to defend it, leaving to the commander-in-chief's discretion to take measures or not for the defence of Bald Hills, where one of Russia's oldest generals would be captured or killed, and he announced to his household that he would remain at Bald Hills. But while himself remaining, he gave instructions for the departure of the princess and Dessalles with the little prince to Boguchárovo and thence to Moscow. Princess Maria,
alarmed by her father's feverish and sleepless activity after his previous apathy, could not bring herself to leave him alone, and for the first time in her life ventured to disobey him. She refused to go away, and her father's fury broke over her in a terrible storm. He repeated every injustice he had ever inflicted on her. Trying to convict her, he told her she had worn him out, had caused his quarrel with his son, had harboured nasty suspicions of him, making it the object of her life to poison his existence, and he drove her from his study, telling her that if she did not go away, it was all the same to him. He declared that he did not wish to remember her existence, and warned her not